Welcome to Herrick Does That, a podcast on current legal topics, relevant industry and legal trends, and significant developments in the law, brought to you by the attorneys of Herrick Feinstein. I am Belinda Schwartz, Herrick's executive chairperson, and I want to thank you for joining us.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Herrick Does That. Today, we explore the business, legal, and financial forces shaping the hospitality and real estate industries. I'm Yarib Ben-Ari, a partner at Herrick Feinstein, and I co-chair our real estate hospitality and leisure practice group. Today, I'm joined by my good friend, Evan Weiss. Hi, Evan.
Hey, how are you, Yarib?
Great. For those of you who don't know, and I think you all do know, Evan is the Chief Operating Officer and Principal at LW Hospitality Advisors, one of the industry's most respected voices in hotel valuation and capital markets. Together, Evan and I are going to be taking a deep dive into how hotels are really appraised, from the fundamentals every investor should understand to the complex valuation dynamics driving deals, refinancing and investment decisions in 2025 and beyond. Whether you're an owner, lender, or asset manager, this episode will give you a sharper lens on what your hotel is really worth and why. Evan, for listeners who might not be familiar with the nuts and bolts, can you walk us through what a hotel appraisal actually involves? What are the key steps? When is it ordered? By whom? From data collection to analysis, give us kind of the 101 so we know what we're talking about when we say hotel appraisal.
Sure. Thanks, Yarib. And it's great to be here today, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. So we're specifically focused on hospitality, obviously. You know, most of our team, we're about a 40-person team in a few different disciplines, primarily valuation, appraisal, feasibility market studies. We also do asset management, consulting, advisory, due diligence, underwriting. And we also have a data analytics platform called LARC, L-A-R-C, Lodging Analytics Research and Consulting, which my partners and I co-founded in January of 2020, which was a great time to be analyzing data. Zero. But in any event, an appraisal at its core is an opinion of value, right? And it is just that. It's part art and part science. We say that because there isn't a specific number that you can say, oh, I'm certain that this property is worth $100 million today, not a penny more, not a penny less. Anyone who tells you that is either going to be super, super lucky or is completely full of it. And we try not to be either. We try to take to really understand what we're doing. So an opinion of value, there are multiple steps in an appraisal. The first things first is visiting the asset, really inspecting the asset, understanding the location, the specific location. In other words, I'll give you a perfect example. If you're in Miami Beach, are you on the water on beach? Are you across Collins Avenue and not on the beach, right? That one block radius, maybe a 200-yard difference in location, could have a demonstrable difference in the amount of income that you can generate from a property, which is one of the three primary methodologies, pardon me, of valuing a property: the income capitalization approach, the sales comparison approach, and the cost approach. Most investors and most lenders use the income capitalization approach. Another thing to understand about appraisers and appraisals is that they are an opinion of value, and appraisers seek to reflect the market. We don't seek to make the market. So folks that are investors, owners, operators, lenders, management companies, brands, et cetera, they are part of the market making, and we reflect that market, react to the market, understand the market, and synthesize a lot of data, location, physical asset, et cetera, and convert that into a value through synthesis and through deep dive analysis. So first things first, understand the asset, understand the location. Are we looking at a Four Seasons? Are we looking in O'Connell Lodge? Are we looking on the beach? Are we looking on a ski slope, ski in, ski out? Are we looking, you know, 10 miles away, right? And then, of course, the condition of the asset, the physical improvement, what type of municipality is it in? Is it a high crime, low crime? And also, what type of environment? Is it a high tax environment like Cook County in Chicago and Illinois? Or is it a relatively low tax environment from a property tax perspective, like many areas in the middle of the country and it's not a political comment, but in a lot of the red states, right? And so again, really understanding, is it a union environment? Is it a non-union environment? Do you have union risk? Do you not have union risk? Ultimately, all of these factors are going towards assisting you in understanding how to put together a forecast of income and expenses going forward, and then ultimately how to convert that to value through a discounted cash flow analysis or a direct cap or a sales comparison approach or through a multiplier analysis of revenue, depending on the type of asset, its location, its revenues, and its ultimate value. So that's a little bit of a kind of a precursor.
So the takeaway is that a TripAdvisor review is not sufficient?
A TripAdvisor view actually is quite helpful. It really helps you understand certain things you may not see when you walk through a property. They may try to show you the best rooms and the best views and the best access. In reality, there's, 100 rooms, and you're going to see, if you're doing an extensive analysis, you're going to see 4 or 5 of those on your tour. Maybe there's 10 of them that are out of service. Maybe the hot water doesn't work. So TripAdvisor is actually a tool that we employ as part of understanding the asset and the location, and also understanding where that asset ranks within its competitive set. Again, it is a tool. It is not a be-all, end-all by any stretch of the imagination. It is another data point, for sure.
So there's a point you hit a little bit when you were talking about availability of data, and I was going to talk about it a little bit later, but I'd like to throw it out there now.
Sure.
When you are in a market that's not as active as you'd like it to be, and there aren't many comparables transaction-wise, sales, refis, and so forth, where do you extrapolate data from in order to be able to give your opinion of value?
In a market where there's a relative paucity of data, there may not be a significant transaction market, there may be very few hotels in that market, or if you think about it in a different way, there may be one great hotel that, let's say it's doing $150 RevPAR, which is a combination of average rate and occupancy. Average rate times occupancy is generally RevPAR, which is a high RevPAR, and the rest of the market is doing 75, right? So you say, how do I value this asset? That's such a unique asset. So first and foremost, we work with the best available data. We can't create data. We can't create sales that aren't there. We can't create costs that aren't there. We can't create competitors that aren't there. However, again, understanding, this is why I would say out of our 40 folks, probably 85% of our team has worked either in a hotel from operationally or went to hotel school from an academic perspective, because we are hotel people in the valuation, advisory, consulting, and asset management and data spaces. We're not data people or appraisers trying to understand hotels. And this is a key component here, right? What makes the hotel tick? What are the demand generators? What does supply look like today? What does supply look like in the future? We also utilize technology, right? Different companies such as CoStar or Build Central or Moody's for economic information. We utilize the best available data, both from a macro perspective and then a micro perspective. We do two things. We look at all the data from the hotel and from the competitive set that we get through, let's say, STR trend reports, Smith Travel Research trend reports. And in addition to that, we have to use our experience. We have to say, okay, I understand this market. We have to talk to the general manager. We have to talk to other competitive hotels. We have to talk to the economic development corps of a certain municipality, certain cities. We talk to tax people, talk to zoning people, as well as, of course, doing the digital work online. So a lot of it in markets like that becomes a bit of a grassroots approach. But in addition to that, we're talking constantly to market players. Our team is on the phone with operators. So we talk to other operators in the market, talk to owners, talk to lenders who have lent in the market. We can ascertain that through TREP or through CoStar. And in addition to that, we're also talking to investment sales and capital markets brokers on a daily basis. And the reason we're doing that is because they really have their ear to the grindstone. Many of these folks are extremely hardworking and they're great at what they do. And we sort of take all of the data available, both the physical data from the property, the physical asset, understanding the market, and then put it all together and try to synthesize it again into a go forward cash flow. Or if it's a smaller asset, say sub 10 million, we may use a direct capitalization approach. If the market is quote unquote stabilized, our opinion is that hotels are never truly stabilized, which is kind of the nature of the hotel business. But in some of these smaller assets, the buyer will do a direct cap, or the buyer for that type of asset will use a room revenue multiplier, right? And when the buyer does that, our job is to reflect the market. And if the buyers are doing that, then we have to reflect that in our valuation, right? More institutional level assets, call that 20 million and above, those buyers are generally doing discounted cash flows, and those buyers are generally looking at sales, but using them as a support on a per key or on overall per hotel unit basis versus the discounted cash flow, which is generally the income capitalization approach, which is utilized mostly by sophisticated investors.
So I want to point out something that you mentioned about data. You mentioned the availability of data from third parties, independent third parties like STR, Smith Travel Research, CoStar, Moody's, and others. For those who aren't U.S.-based, we do have a lot of clients and listeners who are from overseas. They're always surprised to find out that a lot of information they thought would usually be confidential or not available, how much is actually available in the market if you just want to look at, even before you get to an appraisal stage. You want to look at how a hotel is performing historically. You can actually order this information, and it's really readily available for the most part.
A lot of it's masked, as you would imagine. You can't say, oh, I want to know how the Marriott on Third Street's doing in Ohio, in Cincinnati. But you can say, you know what? I'm looking at the Marriott on Third Street in Cincinnati. I'm going to order these 7, 8, 10 hotels that are nearby and get an aggregation of demand demand, supply, average rate, occupancy, and RevPAR for 5, even 10-year periods. So the answer is, yeah, the United States has really evolved, probably even more so than Europe and Asia over the last couple of decades. Smith Travel Research was created in 1987, was purchased by CoStar about 4, 5, 6 years ago. So it's currently part of the CoStar company. Yeah, I mean, Real Capital Analytics is another great data source. Not trying to exclude anyone. Again, CoStar and Real Capital are great with hotel sales.
And you guys also have your own.
And we have our own data analytics platform and go forward projection platform called LARC. LARC covers 63 markets throughout the country, top 25 plus another 35, 40 or so markets, where we produce quarterly subscription based reporting. And we have all sorts of prognostication information on these 63 markets. Again, average rate projections for 5 years, demand, supply, wage growth. We look at employments. We look at convention center data. We try to help project convention center statistics going forward, investment sales. We look at the direction of cap rates, the direction of EBITDA, of the bottom line as well as the top line, which is extremely important based upon a lot of economic factors, rich retail sales, office usage, employment, like I said, wage growth. Is it a union, non-union environment? Is there a CBA renegotiation upcoming like there is in New York? And then in addition to large 63 markets that we cover, there's also a GIS platform, a geographic information systems platform. Not to be too pitchy about it, but ultimately we can project, LARC projects RevPAR in all 19,000 MSAs that contain a hotel in the United States that are covered by CoStar. So it's a pretty incredibly strong platform, population data, household income, as well as RevPAR projections. So again, to your point, and there's algorithms behind it. So is it perfect? Of course not. Is it the best available data out there? Absolutely. And I think that's the point, to your point, right? Being able to ascertain and acquire the best available data to make the best available investment decisions, which is ultimately what we try to do on the appraisal side, whether we're working for lenders, whether we're working for owners, borrowers directly, for attorneys and litigation support matters, as we've worked together on many matters. But, you know, all these types of things are definitely uses of the appraisal side of things. And we seek to put the best available data in so you get the best product out, ultimately.
So let's dive into an appraisal process, right? You've been engaged, you're about to look at a hotel. Walk us through, like, what are the key core, beyond, you know, the great buffet in the morning, okay? What are the core value drivers that you're looking at when you're starting the process?
Yeah. So we'll start with market. We'll start with specific location within the market. We'll look at physical asset, right? Do we need a renovation? Is the roof coming off? Are there leaks? Is there mold? Things of that nature. Or when do they need a renovation? What do we believe? Do they have either a PIP from a brand, a product improvement plan, which dictates the PIP, which dictates the capital expenditures? Or do we believe that a new buyer would put capital expenditures in? Again, trying to reflect how a buyer thinks, even if the hotel is not for sale or for refi at that very moment. And then we start synthesizing data. We're looking for, if it's a newer hotel, what it costs to build. If it's an older hotel, when it was last renovated, how much was put in, what we think going forward the renovations will need. Are there MEP issues, right? Are there mechanical, electrical, or plumbing issues? And then, of course, we start looking at income and expense data, average rate, occupancy for as far back as they have it. We look at P&Ls. We look at a detailed profit and loss statement. We don't just look at, you know, the main categories of rooms and food and beverage, et cetera, administrative in general, sales and marketing, utilities, and on. We look very specifically, are there trends in their data? Then, of course, we take that data and we compare it to comparables that we have in our database of hotels that we've worked on, as well as to general databases and overall comps like that are produced by Smith Travel Research through their host platform or other aggregators of data. And we say, okay, this is an aggregation of 100 to 200 room hotels in the Mid-Atlantic region that are upscale. And we take a look at that and we compare it to that as well. So we're really trying to do a deep dive on the data. Now, are there leases at the hotel? Is the hotel fee simple or leasehold? How do taxes work in that general vicinity? Is there excess or surplus land on the site that can be developed on? What does zoning look like? Are you in Houston where there's no zoning, or are you in New York where there's extraordinarily strict zoning? Whereas you and I both know, literally, there are some buildings that are in multiple zoning districts and you can only build certain heights in some parts of the building and not in others because of where the demising line is, right? The Intercontinental in Times Square is an example of that, where there's a podium because it's in a certain district, which is kind of nutty, but that's the way it is. And so all these things get incorporated into value for proposed hotels and then, of course, for existing hotels going forward. So again, understanding the macro side, also understanding macro, right? Like, if, you know, where are interest rates? We just had a rate cut. Will we have another rate cut? How does that affect how people felt the amount that they can borrow, loan to value, LTV or LTC, loan to cost? As we have seen over just the last five seven, 8 years has shifted from 75 to 50, now to 60, 65, 70 maybe, right? And then the cost of that capital, whether it's from a private equity style lender or it's from a large bank lender or regional bank that you have relationships with, is it recourse or non-recourse? All these things we try to incorporate into our analysis when we're selecting discount rates and terminal capitalization rates for our discounted cash flow analysis. We also have to look at the municipality from a value perspective. In Los Angeles, for instance, there's a mansion tax. Every property over $10 million that sells there, which is like pretty much every property, is taxed at 5.5%. That has to get included in your model. That is a deduct to value. In addition to that, certain states like California, Ohio, even Florida to an extent, others have a tax situation that if you were to sell a property, the asset gets valued at that sale price. If you own a hotel and you bought it for $10 million 20 years ago, and then you're selling it today for $100 million, think about what the tax differential is going to be for the buyer. You may be paying $10,000 a year, for instance, and the buyer may have to pay $250,000 a year. And let's say your capitalization rate was a 10 cap on that asset, right? Think about that. That $240,000 just cost you $2.4 million in your sale price, because now the buyer going forward, and in our case, the appraiser, has to project those new taxes go in the go forward, even though it's theoretical. Even if you're just doing a refinance, that's how things would work. So,
well, you have to be mindful of all the tax, right? Any deal, you have to be mindful of all the tax. If it's the school taxes, the real estate, everything that's going to be affected by the
real estate taxes, property taxes, what we look at. Yeah, we don't,
everything's going to be readjusted in some places.
And then, of course, there's the sentiment, the buyer sentiment, right? Is this a good brand? Is this a bad brand? Is this a desirable or non-desirable? Are there 100 Marriotts in the market and you're the only Hilton, or are there, an equal amount? Maybe you go to a different brand like a Hyatt or an IHG or Wyndham, depending on the asset. So it's all about highest and best use, which is a major tenant in valuation. What is the highest and best use of this building? That's a major aspect of it. If you have a two-story old hotel that's 50 years old that no brand would brand, and you're getting $50 a night and at 30% occupancy, maybe there's an opportunity to convert that to an assisted living home. Maybe there's an opportunity to convert it to residential housing, affordable workforce, or even, like I said, assisted living or dormitories, right? So it really also depends on highest and best use, which is another major tenet of value.
Let's just follow up from there. You spoke about the branding for a second. To what extent does a hotel's brand, be it a soft brand or the management company itself, really move the needle in the appraisal when you're doing it? Is it just adding, some hotel names? Is it just adding some adjectives to the name? Or does it really give substance to the value of the hotel?
It really depends. In certain markets, say like in New York, a brand, and again, every asset is different and it depends, right? It's funny. I used to have a sort of a joke, someone's like, oh, what's a good brand? What's a bad brand, right? So I said, well, let me explain something to you. If you built a Four Seasons on Staten Island, where I'm from, in New York, right, and you put next to it a Hilton Garden Inn, the differential in average in RevPAR, actually average rate differential in RevPAR would probably be like $20, $30. And the Four Seasons, right, probably cost you $1.5 million a key, and the Hilton Garden Inn may have cost you $225,000 a key. So what'd you do? You overbuilt. Theoretically, you can't say Four Seasons is a better brand. It's actually not a better brand because it's economically infeasible. So the Hilton, or the Hilton Garden Inn, as it were, as it is on South Avenue in Staten Island, was the better brand to build in that particular market. But brands definitely matter. Again, brand saturation in a specific market, loyalty programs, frequent guest programs, and other global sales and marketing for a particular brand. Listen, brands also matter for financing. Some banks won't finance you if you don't have a brand, or if you don't have a formal third-party management company, or if you're not approved for management of such brands, right? And sometimes you'll be able to get better financing if you are branded versus non-branded. But again, you have to make that decision. Again, certain markets, it really matters. Certain markets, it doesn't. But I will tell you that certain markets, if a hotel is branded, one of the major brands, which I'm not going to name here, I don't want to exclude anyone, if they had $100 RevPAR and you took that brand or that brand family off of that hotel, their RevPAR would decline by somewhere between 25 and 40%, right? Which means their NOI would decline somewhere in that general vicinity. So is it worth paying the brands 10, 12, 15% of overall revenue through franchise fees, marketing fees, royalty fees, frequent guest programs, et cetera? I would say it is. But the brands also could have a negative impact in the sense, again, with brand saturation or requirements to do certain capital expenditures when you simply don't have the money or the wherewithal to do so. So it is a case-by-case, asset-by-asset, market-by-market consideration as to how important a brand is. But in some cases, it's life and death. And in others, it could be that you'll get a pop in RevPAR and or occupancy or average rate, but the impact from the additional fees may not be worthwhile. It's really an analysis you have to undertake for each asset. And again, because of the highest and best use tenant, we never say that if this if this property wasn't Marriott, for instance, or Hilton or Hyatt or IHG, whatever, if it wasn't one of those brands, it wasn't specifically Marriott, it would have a lower value. We don't do that. We say if this property wasn't branded by a significant major well-known brand, you know, and we may list 5, 6, or 8 brands or whatever it may be, then that would have a detrimental impact to income and therefore a detrimental impact to value.
Do you have that same analysis when it comes to the management companies, not just the brands?
Less so. I think there are, you know, on the brand side, if you think about it, in terms of brand families, there's probably somewhere 6 to 10 majors, right? Obviously, there's dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, right, of independent brands. But let's say we're focusing on the limited select service realm. There's probably over 100 management companies and over 200, you know, owner managers that are capable of doing so. So I think it's a lot more straightforward. I wouldn't say easier, but I would say a lot more straightforward to get a competent third-party management company. So an inherent assumption, I wouldn't call it an extraordinary assumption, but an ordinary assumption of most appraisals is that the property would be operated by competent management, third-party or otherwise.
Let me pause for a second. We've been using some terms and I've been thinking about it. I'm not sure that all of our listeners really understand or may have used these terms before. So let's just maybe help them understand what they are. And those are, the three terms are ADR, RevPAR, and PIP. Let's maybe take one at a time. Can you explain to our listeners what each one generally means?
Yes. ADR stands for average daily rate, which is exactly what it seems like. Total rooms revenue divided by total number of occupied rooms. So that is your average daily rate. RevPAR is a combination of your average daily rate and your occupancy. And the reason that the market, so it stands for revenue per available room, right? So basically you take your total revenue and divide it by your total number of rooms, which is your RevPAR.
Not just the occupied rooms.
Correct, by your available rooms. And the reason why you do that is because for a long time, folks would focus on average rate or occupancy. But if you think about it, if you're even I own a hotel and it's doing $1,000 ADR, but it has 10% occupancy, it has a $100 RevPAR, which is, you know, could be crap. But the point would be that RevPAR shows you RevPAR is a better comparative point than ADR or occupancy taken by itself. ADR is a good comparative point. Occupancy is a good comparative point, but on their own, they really don't show you very much. Vice versa, if we're doing 80% occupancy and the rest of the market is doing 60% occupancy, but our average rate is 100 and theirs is 300, we're leaving a lot of money on the table. So RevPAR really conglomerates the room's revenue into one metric that is a much better comparative point. I will say, though, that today in many resorts or gaming facilities or conference centers, whatever it may be, different assets that are not rooms heavy, let's say that are less than 75% rooms revenue for the entire asset, TrevPAR has become a much, much more utilized term, which is total revenue per available room. And the reason for that is because theoretically, if you run a conference center asset or a gaming asset or a resort would be a great example, right? You could very easily have 30 or 40% of your revenue coming from the rooms, another 40% coming from food and beverage and the like, and then another 20% coming from activities like horseback riding or skiing or whatever it may be, right? And so the revenue per available room, which shows you rooms revenue only as a comparative metric, may not tell you the entire picture of this asset versus other similar assets. And this brings us me to another point, which I'm going to confuse the listener, which is that many cases, you're not necessarily competing against just hotels that are within your, you know, one block radius if it's in an urban market, you know, 10 mile radius if it's in a suburban market, 20 mile radius if it's rural. But if you're like a regional or national resort type property, for instance, you very easily can be competing with hotels or resort properties that are upwards of 200-400 miles away or even across the country potentially. So again, that TrevPAR becomes very relevant because it really becomes about the total revenue that you're bringing in on a per room basis, on a per night basis.
You know, with interest rates where they are still, you know, the tariff environment that's still being addressed and its effect on imports, construction costs are somewhat elevated right now.
Yeah.
And so how does the replacement cost factor into your evaluation, if at all?
I think replacement cost is an interesting metric, but not a value-related one. What I mean by that is that if you think about it, if it's hard to build new hotels in your market, let's look in New York City, right, where there are multiple factors that are hurting new development. One of them is the fact that you and I both know across the country, on average, construction between 2019 and today is up somewhere between 25 and 40%, depending on the type of asset, the builder, et cetera, which is monstrous. That's just on the actual construction and on the labor side, construction material on the labor side and equipment. You factor into that also the fact that it's probably couple hundred basis points more expensive to borrow money for construction financing today. And now you have a project that is about 50% plus or minus more expensive to build. All things being equal, 100 room limited service versus 100 room limited service, somewhere in the 40 to 50% all in differential. Coming back to the main point, how do we include replacement costs into our overall value? The shorter answer is we really don't, unless it's a brand new asset and it recently was costed out and, you know, recently constructed. The longer answer is that it is relevant as a comparative point, but not relevant in the day-to-day. Because as I was saying, theoretically, if you're in a market where you can't build new, the revenue for the hotel should continuously, and hopefully the profit, right, should continuously increase. In New York, you're seeing RevPAR increases and EBITDA increases, earnings before interest, tax, and appreciation, or NOI, net operating income. You're seeing that income increase pretty dramatically, right? And so what's causing that? What's causing that is a relative dearth of new supply, right? And so while replacement costs for an asset may be $500,000 a key and the hotel is getting valued at $250,000 a key, it's because of its ability to generate revenue and therefore returns for its investors. Ultimately, it's all about returns to investors and returns to owners. And so if you cannot produce those returns, it doesn't matter what it costs to build that hotel. It's not its highest and best use, or you simply wouldn't build it today. And so therefore, replacement cost is an interesting idea and thought process, something to understand and know, but not necessarily a dictate or even a metric as it relates to valuing a hotel going forward. Because if you think about it, when we value hotels going forward, it's all about the go forward. It's all about what this can produce tomorrow. And we know. It's about, if I buy this hotel from you today and you were doing a $1 million NOI, yes, that's a great metric. But if I see certain changes in labor, either availability or cost, or if I see certain changes in renovation costs and I have to put in $1 million to that hotel, et cetera, that may reduce my NOI going forward from $1 million to, let's say, $850,000 in a couple of years, or it's going to take a lot to get back to that $1 million given what's happening in a specific market. So again, replacement cost, interesting metric, but not a dictation of value.
Kind of briefly, as we're coming towards the end of our time, are ESG factors and sustainability certifications still a thing beyond having to recycle shampoo bottles, the little ones in the hotel gives out?
You sound crazy when you say tiny little shampoo bottles in a hotel. We now have to have jugs of shampoo affixed to the wall so that everyone knows how sustainably oriented our minds are. Yes, and you have to have multiple garbage cans that say, this is for cans only. No bottles, cans only. Anyway, ESG factors in general have been part of this is my opinion, and part of this is what's actually happening. Many lenders today require a statement and or an analysis of ESG. Are you in a flood zone? Are you in a tornado zone, a fire zone? What's the risk of certain environmental and social factors and, you know, riots and whatever it may be in that specific area? And we have to put in a statement and maybe even do some level of analysis for it. And lenders, I think, are requiring that because their investors are requiring it. The lenders' investors, whether it's, you know, a large scale lender or even a small regional lender. The truth of the matter is, I don't think that most investors really care. They care about what the income that can be produced from that property in a sustainable way. When I say sustainable, I mean that the income is sustainable, not necessarily that the property is sustainable. So I think that a lot of what people talk about on ESG and they care about it, whether it's certain brands that are specifically focused on sustainability and on the environment, the reality is to me, most of those, not all, most of those are economically based, they're marketing based, and the owner and or the buyer cares much less about it than may be seen. Now, if you build a hotel that's ESG friendly and it has a certain LEED rating and, you know, your HVAC costs are down by 50%, or you have solar or geothermal, whatever type of energy that you can generate, right? That's great. I mean, those are dollars. Ultimately, those dollars get translated to value, not necessarily their certification that gets translated to value. But it is important to some buyers. It is important to some guests. So from a marketing perspective, it's important. And it is important to some to lenders today where they're requiring statements and or analysis associated with it.
So as we're coming to the last quarter of 2025, what is your outlook for 2026? Good, bad, a little of both?
Yeah, from an operational perspective, I mean, LARC is projecting negative RevPAR for the first time in our 5-6 year history. Most prognosticators and most analysts are projecting negative RevPAR for the big C corps. You know, C corps being the publicly traded C corps like Marriott, Hilton, Hyatt, etc. And a lot of the REITs like Host, Diamond Rock, you know, Pebblebrook, etc. Apple, Summit, you know, Sunstone. All those, a lot of those are also projecting negative rates this year, specific to certain of them that are that are more susceptible to the current environment. So the operating environment is relatively soft. Some of that is economically based. Some of that is tariff based. Some of that is rhetoric based from the administration. And some of that is just, again, it's more macro in the sense that people aren't as comfortable with their jobs. The job losses are starting to tick up and unemployment is starting to tick up a little bit. And we saw job additions at very low rates over the last, the payroll additions have been very low over the last several months. And all that affects leisure travel as well as corporate group, as well as corporations wanting to send their travelers on individual business travel and how much they're willing to spend on those trips. So we're not seeing massive declines. We're not looking at a massive recession in my humble view. I am not an economist by any stretch of anyone's imagination, including my own. But that being said, there's definitely some softness in the economy, which I think, and again, softness in the U.S.'s reputation globally that is affecting inbound travel. Inbound international travelers generally stay for longer and spend more. It is interesting. The Asian traveler has not come back in a meaningful way since COVID began. That region's travel is definitely a lot lower than it was prior to COVID. And the interesting thing right now is that the U.S. dollar is actually lower overall, which is an interesting thing because usually when the U.S. dollar is low, European and Asian and South American travelers will flock to the United States because it's on sale. But we have not really seen that in mass. And that could be due to the wars and where the U.S. is supporting and, you know, and a lot of other different factors around the world. But, and domestically, I think people are somewhat afraid of the jobs. You know, I always remind people when people talk about the United States of America, people and the media especially tend to look at the left coast and the right coast, right? East coast and the west coast. Yeah, there's, we'll call it 100, 125 million people living there. There's also 200 plus million people living in the middle of the country. And those people travel too. And those people are businesses too. And those people, and of course, they're not homogeneous in how they think or act or do anything, but or travel in this case, but there's real relative concern about where the economy and their jobs are going. And therefore, could be a pullback in both leisure and on the corporate side. We summer this year as well. So expecting 26 to be relatively soft. And I think that in many markets, unions are getting more challenging and labor will continue to tick up. And that will also continue to challenge NOIs and EBITDAs. And in addition to that, renovations will become more expensive due to tariffs. I'm already hearing from people that are renovating their homes or that have manufacturing businesses that there's nowhere to go with those tariff dollars. They have to start getting passed on to customers. So we'll start seeing people's lives get more expensive and products in hotels and for hotels get more expensive. And that just ends up with potentially higher costs, which or same revenue, higher costs, lower NOI. So I think we have some headwinds. I mean, I'm generally optimistic about 2026, but also realistic. And the realistic nature is you're probably looking at RevPAR growth relatively flat to negative and EBITDA growth probably down 200 to 400 basis points with increases in insurance, increases in taxes, and also now labor that we're very concerned about.
Evan, this has been, from my perspective, truly informative. I always enjoy speaking with you. I always learn something. I welcome you to come back again, maybe kind of towards the end of the first quarter to see if your prediction are going in that direction. Hopefully they're not. They'll improve.
Agreed.
And, you know, if anybody wants to get in touch with you, happy to put them in touch with you because you are truly of great value in providing information and direction. So thank you. As always, thank you for participating. This has been a wonderful podcast and we look forward to hearing from all of you. If you have any questions, send them in. Thank you.
Arif, thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you very much for joining us for Herrick's podcast, Herrick Does That. To learn more about our firm and to listen to additional podcast episodes, please visit us at www.herrick.com.